that it's environment that's so strong. So we talk about, oh, we're going to find it's genetic, et cetera, et cetera. And yet all the research we've done now up to this point tells us that the genetic part of this, there might be some genetic vulnerability, but genes don't, there's no schizophrenia gene. It isn't there. So we're just spending money going down this path because, aha, we can do genetic research, you know, and there's money for it, and it makes us feel all talented and skilled and advanced. But I'm very cynical that it's going to really help those so diagnosed. And one last little quick thing. We recently read that, oh, they might have found a gene for depression. And what they found was, it seemed like, what was it they found? 70% of people who had had four traumatic episodes in a certain amount of time became depressed if they had this certain allele related to serotonin. Okay, sounds like, oh, maybe there's some genetic connection. Well, first of all, it's like 70% of people have that genetic allele. I mean, it's ridiculous. So whenever you get into this, oh, we're going to find a gene for it, and we know it's genetic-based, if you actually go to the research and start looking at it critically, what you find time and time again is that the best you can say is that it appears there may be some genetic vulnerability in some people so diagnosed, but there sure isn't any, quote, schizophrenia gene. So
thank you.
Going to be wasted money.
We're talking with Robert Whitaker, Mad in America author. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM or www.freakradio.org. It's about 11:10. Can we keep you for an extra 15 minutes after 11:30?
Yeah, sure.
Great. This show normally concerns itself a lot with civil rights for people on the streets, and that's something we haven't really talked about at all, and that isn't talked about too much in your book, but you do in your discussion about involuntary outpatient treatment, which I guess is, or outpatient commitment, which is what I call it, is needles on wheels. They can come to your house and shoot you up with drugs.
Right.
In 42 states, including California, if the counties opt in and if they have adequate resources. That has only been the case in L.A. County, as far as I know so far, but and only in a very limited number of people. We have AB 1421, the law that was passed last year, and again, as a build like a lot of this as a way of helping people with severe problems. What is the impact of all this on homeless people, and how would you link it in with that situation?
Well, first of all, I think sometimes you drive people to be homeless because they don't want to be in situations where they're forced to take the drugs. So often you'll see that shelter or some sort of involvement with the to get help from the system is you got to agree to take these drugs. So you're presented with a choice, right? And next thing you know, you're bailing out because you don't want the drugs. That's number one. Number two is, we hear this thing, oh, people are homeless because they're not taking their medications. Well, I think they're homeless because oftentimes there's no good affordable housing. I mean, we look at this and we have, homeless in California, you go to San Francisco, they're everywhere. Well, tell me where the affordable housing is in San Francisco. Where is it in New York City? Where is it in Boston? So where we should be putting our resources is in building affordable housing and good care rather than in saying to people, you have to take these drugs. And what they have found, like the Bazelon Law Center is if you present it in this manner, a manner of choice, that you can get just as good in choice in any sort of situations where you are providing shelter, you're providing other things, you can get the same level of compliance as you were with these sort of forced orders that cause some people, to bail and go into the street.
Compliance, you mean in taking drugs?
In taking drugs.
So, but given our whole discussion, that's not what we want, is it?
Oh, and yeah, let me give you a study. I agree. Think about this. There was a study done by University of Pennsylvania recently that looked at MRIs, that used MRIs, and studied the changes caused by the drugs over an 18-month period. So they took newly diagnosed patients and watched what happened to their brains caused by the drugs. And what they found is that the drugs caused an enlargement of the basal ganglia over an 18-month period. And now here's the kicker, that as that enlargement occurred, people's symptoms worsened. They became, both their psychotic positive symptoms, the psychosis, and the negative symptoms, the withdrawal, worsened. Not improved, worsened. Now, that's actually a pretty clean study showing people being made chronically ill by drugs, right? So why would we do that? And that's apart from all the negative things, that it makes them feel emotionally lethargic and ruins their motor movement. On the very symptoms we're trying to treat, they found the drug use was associated with, and I quote, a greater severity of symptoms.
Well,
so why would we do that?
It has increased the profits of the pharmaceutical industry involved by about tenfold,
Yeah, now you know the answer. It's a form of care that increases profits, but it doesn't help people recover over the long term. And frankly, and you know, now we have this new thing where we're developing implants in the brains, so we'll put drug implants, and the drugs will be released slowly over the course of a year. How think about this? How does a society have the right to do to that to someone who doesn't want the drugs? Would you like that done to you?
No way.
No way, right? You're taking over that person's being. And you know what? When this was done in the 70s by the Soviet Union to their dissidents, we, psychiatrists and Congress, criticized that as a form of putting people, we criticized as a form of torture, of putting people in a spiritual gas chamber. That's what we said to the Soviets when they were using neuroleptics on their dissidents. But when we do it to our people on the streets and in jails, et cetera, say you have to take these drugs, and we forcefully inject them with Haldol. By the way, the forcible injections often are with the older neuroleptics. We say, we're doing this for your own good. We're treating you with efficacious medicines. And if you resist, it's because you don't know what's good for you. Well, that is an intellectually indefensible position.
Well, if Ephraim Torrey claims that there's a disease called, what is it, nosologenia or something, that indicates insufficient understanding of the wisdom of your local psychiatrist, I'm not sure.
It's that that you, the patient, don't have the wisdom to understand that you're sick.
Right.
So in other words, think about this. You're absolutely disempowered. All of a sudden you're said to be crazy, and you need to take these drugs, and you say, no, I'm fine. I don't need these drugs, and I hate the way they make them feel. They say, oh, that's because you don't know how you feel. You don't know that you, in fact, will feel better when we give you these drugs. But you say, I've been on the drugs, and I don't feel better. And then they say, well, that's too bad. You don't know what you're talking about.
We have a question from our first email question, for those who want to email in, rnorths2@hotmail.com for you, Bob.
Okay.
It's from Maria. I've been on medication for 17 years. There really isn't anyone who encourages you to stop taking the medications. Right now I'm taking Depakote, Escalif, Klonopin, Wellbutrin, Filthron, and Geodin, and they tell me that I should plan on taking these drugs my entire lifetime. I hope that in the future there is more of a movement to get people off medication. Workers in mental health facilities act more like prison guards. Why don't they have people who have better training in mental health facilities? Do you see the time in the future where people are encouraged to get off the medication?
Wonderful question. 17 years down, and how many drugs is he on? I didn't count them all, but there was 5 or 6, right?
Yeah.
That's absolutely common. That's the new thing with these atypicals, by the way, because particularly with the atypicals, they don't seem to knock people out enough. So next thing you know, they're on 3, 4, or 5 drugs.
And they're expensive, right?
And they're expensive. Mm. So by the way, so if the drugs work so well, how come you're on 6 drugs? That's my question. Exactly right, though, here is, if you look at the history of 50 years, and you look at the number of studies done where they tried to help people get off, gradually, okay? You go abruptly off these drugs, you have a really hard time, and no one should go abruptly off the drugs. It's a disaster, agreed, et cetera. And it's because of these changes you've had in your brain. But they've only done a few studies where they tried, as this person who wrote, to help people get off the drugs, gradual withdrawal, okay? And what did they find? Harvard researchers reported this, I think, in 96. They looked at all such studies, and they found that only 1/3, when gradually withdrawn, we're talking about people diagnosed with schizophrenia, relapsed within 6 months. And I quote, those who didn't relapse had an excellent chance of remaining well indefinitely. In other words, we got 65% off, and it looked like they were going to do well indefinitely. And since we know the drugs are so problematic, why wouldn't that be the form of care? And why wouldn't we give everybody a chance to go off the drugs slowly and support them as they did that? Support them, and that doesn't mean just say, okay, you want to go off? Good luck. It means monitoring them, supporting them, providing nurturing support. Well, we don't do that, do we? And we don't do it because, again, it threatens this paradigm of care that is bringing profits to so many, saying that you have a chemical imbalance or you have a biological disorder and this drug helps fix it and that's why you need to be the drugs on life for life brings huge profits. But what does it do to individuals? It leads people down a path to where your person who wrote in is. Next thing you know, you're 17 years on these drugs. You don't generally work. You're on multiple drugs and fighting with all the sort of problems that they bring. And I hate to say this, go to places and find out how often they're dying in their 40s and late 30s and early 50s now. Early death with this multiple polypharmacy is a huge problem.
Robert,
go ahead.
The double Robert. One of the tactics I've observed that physicians have, psychiatrists have used is to say, well, try just a little bit longer, and it takes about 3 weeks for the drug to get into your system, so there's no way you could be positive that there's anything happening. And then if that's not happening, we'll switch you to another medication, and that continues, and you're still on this old medication.
Right.
You don't know how the two are combining.
Right.
One's possibly causing another symptom because you're on the other simultaneously. And then this is another question I was going to ask you about the drug testing studies where they abruptly withdrew patients from these drugs and not trying to help anyone get off gradually or anything, just to see what would happen
right
to these people.
Well, going back to the polypharmacy, there's no studies anywhere, any place that has any evidence as to why this would work, okay? In other words, what that woman wrote in, there's no studies saying this mix of five drugs will produce positive results. You don't have it. Second of all, it doesn't make sense because if you see what the drugs are actually doing, so for example, she's on an antipsychotic, a Geodon. Well, that knocks down dopamine activity. Then she has an antidepressant in there. That increases dopamine activity. So it's like you're pulling the patient in two different ways, and it's just as you said. What happens is the initial drug causes a certain deficit in dopamine activity. Then you got to have a drug to compensate for that, to try to, you know, compensate for those side effects, and you end up in this horrible spiral. As to the drug tests, yeah, they're ridiculous. What happens when they test these new drugs, these new antipsychotics, is they'll abruptly withdraw patients off the drugs to make, and the hope is that, and the hope is the right word is here, the expectation is that will make them psychotic, okay? And then having made them psychotic, they'll put one group on the new atypical, and then they'll leave the other one, and they'll call that the placebo group. And they'll see if the atypical or the new drug diminishes psychosis a little bit better than those, you know, just left going through this abrupt withdrawal. And yeah, the irony of that is, so we have bad clinical care is really the placebo group. And if you actually look at the outcomes, even that abrupt withdrawal group that remains on placebo sometimes isn't doing much worse at 6 weeks than the, or at 3-4 weeks than the drug-treated group. But the point is, if they did it with gradual withdrawal, or if they did it in newly diagnosed patients, they very likely wouldn't get studies showing their drugs as very as efficacious at all, and then the whole thing would crumble.
Robert, this is Jennifer. Hi. What was sent in was quite profound, and if I can bring it into the realm of something that maybe you could give us some more insight into in speaking about this, what about medical malpractice in this particular area, where you have someone that has gone through the system of ill care, improper treatment, and realizes through their own studies and findings, or listening to shows like this, or doing readings of your book, that lo and behold, aha, you know, I've been taking these drugs all these years. You've also correlated in your research about brain dysfunction from these drugs. What happens then? Where can they find a so-called retribution, or to be thrust back into saying, hey, something wasn't right in my treatment? Where's that? Have you found any studies upon that type of research?
Well, there's a couple things that happen here. There have been a few successful cases related to tardive dyskinesia with the older neuroleptics like Haldol and all, successfully litigated. And in fact, the reason that the American Psychiatric Association actually decided to make doctors to respond to this problem, which was so pronounced, was because of the lawsuits. They started to become afraid of losing lawsuits. However, it's tough to win these suits for two reasons. And I think lawsuits are the place to go, but it's tough to win for a couple reasons. A, the drug companies have a lot of money, and they will hire consultants who have nice academic credentials to say whatever needs to be said. I hate to say it, but they'll just spin a story that's not even remote. You know, they'll just lie is the only way to put it. So you have, quote, experts that will downplay any risk or downplay any associations, and often they'll say, oh, this was caused by the disease, not by the drugs. So you got that problem. The second problem is that the courts as a whole, the system doesn't really care much about the mentally ill. So if they get sick, let's say they get tardive dyskinesia, or even diabetes or something like that. Well, they'll say, like, well, better diabetes than psychosis. So they'll say it's an acceptable side effect, et cetera. So the system, and it's very hard to fight the sense of, hey, listen, I wouldn't be chronically ill if it weren't for these drugs. So it's hard. I would say the best hope is through lawyers. There are some lawyers now beginning to litigate over the diabetes being induced by the atypicals, which the FDA is finally now warning about. There isn't good redress, but the best, I guess, is to try to get a lawyer who's willing to work on this.
And also to bring it back into maybe the more scientific approaches, because what I'm hearing from you is discussing some aspects of, you know, finding the courts not to be a good place to go, and then we also talked a lot about today, you know, the doctors that are prescribing these medications, and I don't want to say they don't have a firm grasp on what exactly the mental illness is or schizophrenia in hard science, then what would you say to those people that hold a view that the whole psychiatric or psychotherapeutic approach is more pseudoscience than actually hard science?
Well, you know, one of the things I've tried to do is just look at mainstream psychiatry and the purveyors saying, ha-ha, we're a science and here's our story, is to look at their own research. So I avoid coming at this as seeing as if I'm against psychiatry or a critic of psychiatry in general. So I just looked at this, and I certainly wasn't when I began. What does your own research show? Okay, so I'm even going to take you at face value that there is such a thing as schizophrenia, is such a thing as bipolar, and that you can accurately diagnose it. But do your studies show that in the aggregate, your form of treatment help or hurt? Okay, so and I'm going to let you see what your studies show. That's number one. So that's how I try to approach it. The problem with psychiatry and when you get into pseudoscience is that you certainly could have a form of care that would help people who are distressed in mind, okay? That makes perfect sense. The problem is the science of psychiatry as it is peddled today, it's not honest because it's so influenced, it's so filtered by drug money, so influenced by drug money and filtered through a prism of like religious beliefs saying, it's like they stomp their feet and say, these have to be mental disorders and we're going to prove that and prove that our drugs work. So they're not scientists in the sense of open-minded investigation of this stuff. They're trying to prove what they want to believe. So in that sense, it is a pseudoscience because at least as a whole, when you see the research agenda and when you see how things are reported, there isn't the honesty and integrity you associate with good science.
Thank you.
We're talking to Robert Whitaker in the studio, Jennifer Gosk and Coral Brune. I'm Robert Norris, Free Radio Santa Cruz, what you're listening to, 96.3 FM, www.freakradio.org. To email a question, rnorris2@hotmail.com. To call in a question, 429-8529, and my producer will put it on email and email it to me. We have about 20 minutes left in the show. You know, to me, Bob, I was interested in the fact that we've been focusing a lot on drugs, as we should, and the deleterious effects of drugs, but the whole business of the role these drugs perform, not just in terms of making profits, but in terms of legitimizing what psychiatrists do, giving them some answer to the issue of, doctor, how can you help me? Ah, this is how we and we alone can help you. Something you illustrated nicely in your book, or at least that's one of the theses of your book, and you show a series of different kinds of therapies at different times in U.S. history and in Western European history, each of which, with the exception of moral treatment, sounds progressively more gruesome than the last. Do you want to give the audience sort of a brief synopsis of the enduring mistreatment of the mentally ill?
Sure, and this is actually quite interesting, and I don't know if a lot of readers have picked up on this, is doctors will always come to believe in the efficacy of their therapies. So whatever the therapy may be, and we'll go through this litany of therapies, they always believed in them at that time. And you have to believe in them, because otherwise you wouldn't give them. I mean, at some level at least you have to believe in them. So the capacity for doctors to delude themselves is very powerful. We've seen this throughout the history of medicine, not just in psychiatry, as therapies of one time, next thing you know, are seen as harmful 30 years later. And so we have to recognize that there is this powerful capacity for delusion in medicine. And in modern times, yeah, it's drugs. But of course, we have a drug-based culture. That's what defines medicine. That's what, by and large, defines going to a doctor. You go into a doctor with a complaint, and the doctor writes a prescription. That's the basic ritual we have. And psychiatry, which frankly historically has had a bit of an inferiority complex that maybe they weren't really doctors, have always wanted to fit themselves into that mold. And so, of course, they want to adopt this ritual of drug prescribing. So there is that emotional self-perception, egotistical reason for this drug-based care we have. Anyway, going back towards this history of somatic treatments for madness, what you see in them is that, in a way, they all did work in the sense of finding ways to quiet people, to make their symptoms less visible. So, for example, in Benjamin Rush's time, this is in the late 1700s, and Benjamin Rush was sort of the first physician in America, they would do things like spinning therapy. And they would put them on a board, and they would rotate them really rapidly around until they basically become sick and nauseous. And they would weaken them in that way, and then they'd send them back to their room. And the people would be so weak and physically ill, of course, they wouldn't be able to bother anybody.
Before Rush, you even had bleeding and emetics, right?
Oh, yeah, and Rush used those as well. And you can see the weakening. They would bleed so much that basically they'd put them near death, and of course they weren't going to be physically strong and capable of causing problems. The emetics, they would give them an emetic day after day after day after day. And actually, this arose from a belief that the mentally ill, the mad, were like animals, and you needed to weaken them. So the weakening them was deliberate, whether it be by bleeding or by emetics, etc.
Or by beating and whipping, correct?
Well, and then if you go back far enough, yeah, the idea was, okay, they've lost their reason, therefore they're no longer human, and therefore they needed to be treated as beasts, and one way to subdue them, this is in the very first English medical textbooks, would be to, whip them, beat them. And you needed to inspire this fear in the doctor. So it becomes a control issue, obviously, clearly.
In the 1930s, also on the wards, was written that some of the patients were controlled by the ward masters, whatever they were called, by almost strangling the patients in the showers with wet towels,
right,
or putting a bar of soap in a sock and knocking them unconscious just to keep so-called order.
Well, exactly. And, one of the confusions you often have in mental hospitals, mental settings, right, is the doctors will be talking about their therapies, and the patients will be experiencing them as being controlled. And so what you'll see is, quote, therapies that are also designed to make people more manageable. And then once you get a little ways away from the therapies, you have attendants sometimes, at least in the 1930s, who were, as you said, they were doing things like wet toweling them and practically strangling them to maintain some sort of order. And also because under the eugenics, you had this incredible hatred directed towards the mentally ill. So, but that's what you saw, and then you know, Rush became famous, just as we go real quickly forward on this, Rush became famous for a form of inventing what was called the tranquilizer chair. And so what he would do is he would set people in a chair, and he'd bound them so they couldn't move at all, couldn't move a muscle, and he'd keep them there for days on end, and there was a little hole in the bottom so they could defecate in that manner. And then while they were seated there, he would bleed them. He would throw ice over the head, dump water on them, and the idea was that he was either cooling their brain and this was a biological cure for madness. And
circulatory disorder.
Exactly. That this was a circulatory disorder, and he was curing it. And guess what happened? After hours of this treatment, people didn't want to go back in the tranquilizer chair, and they'd be too weak, and they would indeed bother people less and be less resistant. So what they say, we have a cure for madness.
Don't forget blistering.
Oh, and blistering, yeah. They would raise blisters on the scalp. Sometimes, even scalding was seen in the old days as having some benefit. And then there was something called drowning therapy, where the idea was that you would hold the head underwater for a time until they passed out, and then when you pulled them back up, theoretically, some sort of new consciousness could enter their mind. The patients experience this as torture, as attacks, etc.
And you, in fact, quoted Benjamin Rush at the beginning of your book as saying, terror acts powerfully upon the body through the medium of the mind and should be employed in the cure of madness.
Yeah, and the thing I think that's interesting about that, I mean, besides sort of sickening, is Rush was a good guy. I mean, Rush was a thoughtful human being. He actually came from a Quaker tradition. He actually urged overall we need to have more humane care. But what happened was he studied in England or Scotland, and he studied all the English medical textbooks of the day, and he said, well, this is what the medical textbooks teach, so yeah, I want to treat them nicely overall, but when I get into medicine, I need these harsh, aggressive methods to knock out madness. So you see right in Rush this incredible ability to go down a wrong path, is the only way to put it, with the idea that medicines and therapies that make people more manageable, more controllable, and knock out the visible symptom are to be seen as cures.
You also point out special interest groups have come into play, like neurologists around the time of the American Civil War.
Yeah, what happened after the Civil War is, you think about the mentally ill as a group of patients, now from a business point of view, as a group of patients that people want to treat because money can be made, okay? So we're going to look at this as a business point of view. So the asylum superintendents had control, the moral treatment asylum superintendents had control of the mentally ill. And they might get paid okay running the asylums. Then in the Civil War, the neurologists come along, and it's a discipline that comes along really to treat gunshot wounds and all. But then the Civil War ends, and they lack patients. There's not enough people getting shot. So what they start saying, mental disorders are neurological disorders, and we can treat them by treating their nerves. It really was just a patient grab. And next thing you know, you had all sorts of talk about how, like I said, mental disorders were nervous disorders, and there'd be electrical treatments and different treatments for soothing the nerves. But it really was a grab by neurologists. And you need to think about this, especially today, is you've got people who are looking for customers. And that means drug companies looking for customers, and psychiatrists looking for customers, and so they're going to tell a story that helps bring in as many customers as well. And the biggest thing I think as part of this history we should review is, because it's still influencing our care, is the eugenic era. And like I said, after the neurologist, then we moved on to this eugenic period in which we said the mentally ill had defective genes, and schizophrenia was said to be a single gene disorder handed down in the same way blue eyes are, and they're breeding like crazy, and so what do we need to do to protect our population? Well, we passed laws saying the mentally ill can't marry. Well, that didn't work so well because the mentally ill didn't say they were mentally ill.
Forget to pull their teeth while you're doing that.
Oh, yeah. Well, then we had such cures as, well, then we started saying, well, let's put them in asylums and keep them there because that way they can't come out and have babies. And then we said, well, let's forcibly sterilize them. And then as we were doing this in the night, I don't know why I'm almost laughing. It's just because it's so absurd. But the cure of the early 1920s, there was a guy named Cotton who said, I've found the cure for mental illness. It's a mouth infection, and the way we cure madness is we just pull all their teeth. And next thing you know, he was reporting huge cures with this somatic treatment. But unfortunately, when people looked into what was happening, people were dying. He started. What he had was a theory that infection was the cause of mental illness. He started with the teeth, and if that didn't work, he started removing other body parts. Gallbladder, I forget what all he was removing. He would just move on to the internal body parts. So he makes these claims of how wonderful he's doing, the cures, etc. And then people, when they actually do some follow-up, they find that many are dying and having absolute horrible times.
And he was never held to account for that, was he?
No, not at all. In fact, he was often praised at the time. And he was allowed to disappear into, oblivion with no real scandal at all attached to it. In fact, it actually absolutely disappeared until 1986. A guy named Andrew Scull, he's a professor in California who unearthed this whole story. And so, in other words, here's the point. After they even found how harmful this surgery was, these different surgery was, rather than have a big scandal, they let him go on, keep on doing it for a while. It was amazing. In other words, the patient didn't count better to protect the image of psychiatry and this particular doctor than prevent patients who were still undergoing the blade in this way. It was really quite remarkable. Shows the complete devaluation of the patient during this time.
Robert, in your book, you also talk about the times where the moral therapy treatments that were used were helping, and that at a certain point in history, you talk about the doctors or those that carried, the stamp of approval of science coming in and saying, you don't know what you're doing in here. And then there was a certain transitional point of having moral therapy and the leaders of the asylums or the treatment centers being removed and having doctors coming in to say, this is the way we're going to run things. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah,
from your
this
book?
Is really interesting because it happened, I think, in three waves. The initial doctors who were made asylum superintendents under when the moral therapy arose, often did have a religious background to their treatment that they brought to the treatment, whether they be Quakers, many of them were Quakers, and they saw themselves. There was a guy named Kirkpatrick at the University of the Pennsylvania Asylum, and he was absolutely wonderful. I mean, his idea was that he would be a guide in the sense of a father figure, comforting. And so this first, and many were like him, this first group of early superintendents, and their sense was, we need to make this home work, and that's we're going to make a home work, and that home is going to nurture people back to health. And they weren't believers in the somatic treatments, and they even, for example, tried to very much minimize any use of restraints. Restraints were seen as, cruel, et cetera.
And violence was not really a hallmark of either side.
No, absolutely not. In fact, if you look at Kirkpatrick, he talked about how I want attendants who make sure they know that they don't use violence. That was one of the things he screened people for. I want people who, can manage people without resorting to violence, etc. So the effort was to remove that element of force from the asylums. And from everything you can read is, if they didn't need restraints and stuff very often at all during these early asylums, that people in fact could be encouraged to behave as long as they were treated well. What happened then was, again, we got this reform by Dix, and all of a sudden instead of having small places where a doctor could preside over a home, you ended up with 1,500 patients in a hospital, 2,000 people in a hospital, and that there was no longer a place for an individual doctor to tend to 2,000 people. And what states started looking for at that point was, okay, they might be a doctor, but was someone who could manage budgets. And so the original real believers in moral therapy died, passed away, and they were replaced by state appointees who were, and there was a lot of patronage, et cetera, who really hadn't grown up in the form of therapy, and now were just being seen, keep these budgets down. Now, at that point, we start to see the decline of moral therapy, decline of people recovering, and now we get this new discipline of neurologists come along, and they say, aha, we're going to bring real medicine, modern science to the form of mentally ill, and at that point, the psychiatrists, in order to counter the neurologists, say, aha, we're going to be scientists as well. We're going to bring a scientific approach. And you had two different groups sort of competing for patients, both boasting of bringing scientific approaches to the mentally ill and completely forgetting this sort of effectiveness of treating people like human beings.
And your book also covers the grand guignol of horrors, ranging from insulin therapy, shock therapy, lobotomy, the traveling lobotomist who would come in and snip your lobes while you wait.
Right.
All kinds of... it would be amusing if it weren't so horrifying. The problem is we're running out of time here, and we only have five or 10 minutes left. We have a question from a woman named Elizabeth. She asks you by email, I'm a pre-med student. I'm interested in studying psychiatry. I'm interested in studying the effects of pollution on mental disorders and the use of nutrition for treatment. Do you have any schools you could recommend?
Boy, I'd love to see more research of that sort. That's great. Offhand, no. I don't have any schools that come to mind that are really, you know, encouraging people that want to go into psychiatry to do this path. The person they could contact is a gentleman in Canada, a doctor named Adam Hoffer, who's been using nutritional approaches to schizophrenia for a long time, knows this history very well, and I think he could recommend wherever you might be able to get some training in that regard. But that's the person, and look, you can look him up on the internet. It's Hoffer. He's in Western Canada somewhere, and I know you can use the internet to get a hold of him and send him an email. And he's the foremost guy, I think, in understanding the history of how nutrition really can help people with mental disorders.
Coral and Jennifer, you have some final thoughts or questions for Bob Whitaker here.
I just wanted to say that it was a pleasure having this discussion for the past 2 hours with you, and how illuminating some of the things that are in your book should be dispersed out through fact and through a good read of your book. I just wanted to say thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's such an important topic. I mean, your lives are really in the balance, and I just wish I could be more optimistic that there were more forces for change, such as your radio station.
Yes, and I'd like to thank you as well. I'd recommend your book, and I really feel that for people who are struggling or that need information that's well researched, it's well reviewed. I think you've made a challenge for the medical model people, and it's about time. And I'm hope to talk with you again or hear your research or read another book. Thank you.
Well, again, thanks for having me. Thanks for the kind words.
And Bob, I can't say how accurate your book is because I haven't read the studies, and I can't really, I mean, I'm jumping on board, of course, because you're a very persuasive writer, and I also tend to share an anti-psychiatric bias. I'd like, of course, to have you faced head-to-head with some of your critics and see the two of you or the 18 of you going at it. Maybe we can have you come back when we can persuade Tory or some other... Tory actually is something of a maverick, right, in his field. He's viewed by establishment psychiatrists.
Yeah, Tory is. It's interesting. I mean, he was a big critic of the mainstream, especially in the 70s, and even wrote a book about how Western psychiatry is basically no better than shaman medicine, but then he switched, and I don't know the reason for that. But he is considered a maverick within the field, no question.
Have you had any debates that perhaps those who are...
I did, on The Connection, which is an NPR station,
mm-hmm.
And you can actually, people can download that debate from the internet, and they had on a doctor named Lieberman, who's very big in biological research and in... one of the leaders in this. In fact, he's now conducting a trial comparing the atypicals to the old drugs. And that got pretty heated. And so that's at least one place you can see.
So you look up you and Lieberman and The Connection, and you'll find that?
Yeah, you can just go to The Connection's archives, and it's on the archives.
The Connection is a television show? Or?
It's a radio show put out by NPR in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you just go to the connection.org or something, or connection.org, but use Google and you can do it, and there you can download that debate, and you can see you know, you have a doctor there, obviously, who was very not happy with me, and you can see how the debate went.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any debates on the left with people who are advocates of Zaz or strong Scientologists or Reagan types? Or do you find yourself on the outs with those folks too?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I sort of got attacked from both sides at times. I mean, obviously, the Zaz folks were happy about part of it because, of course, I was, you know, looking at the research and saying that the story that's commonly told doesn't hold up, but they criticized me for basically implying that mental disorders were real and taking that for granted, et cetera, et cetera. I think one review said, he's not an abolitionist, he's an apologist, or something like that was what they said. And regardless of that, I guess my feeling on that is this. The problem with Zaz, as interpreted, and et cetera, is that I think we do have to acknowledge that people can become very distressed in mind, and they can reach moments in their life when they need help, and that, frankly, some people do become chronically ill. So he's right, I think, in the sense that when you say the myth of mental illness, because there is this story that we know that they're biological disorders, et cetera, and that, in fact, hasn't played out. But when we start saying that people can't, you know, when we just say that people can't have these things going on with their mind, I don't think that is very helpful either.
Because the most important question, I guess, that many people listening, we had a discussion last week with local advocates, Jane Kaiser and John Stewart were in the studio,
right.
Representatives of PIRC, Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective. What do you do when a parent or a client comes up to you and says, what am I going to do? How can I make the choice of whether to take these medications or not?
Yeah, that's the problem, right? Because they need to be told honestly what the drugs do and what the side effects are. I think, you know, people should be given a choice. I do believe that drugs can help, you know, can have a place in how we, you know, that of the options out there. Only thing I can say is somehow that information and that choice has to be made in a context of a lot of information and all the information and the honest information. And that is that you know, there's this problem of chronicity and there's going to be the side effects and here's how the drugs work. They don't balance brain chemistry. They profoundly block certain neurotransmitters and just have the whole discussion take place within that form of honest information.
Any other books you recommend to folks on the subject?
On schizophrenia or books on mental illness?
Both.
Well, this doesn't help you for care, but there's a book by Mary Boyle on the science, just about the science of the whole story about where the schizophrenia diagnosis came from, and I think it's called The Delusion of Schizophrenia. It's a real good book for understanding that this broken brain stuff is really nonsense. So that's number one.
What's it called?
It's called Schizophrenia Scientific Delusion, I think is what it's done. She's a PhD in England.
Mm-hmm.
You can also, there's some very good work that's been done by David Cohen. It's not a book, but just on neuroleptics. And I think you can get that through the Mind Freedom's website, www.mindfreedom.org. There's another wonderful book called Out of Bedlam by Anne Braden Johnson, who talks about, she worked in mental hospitals for a long time, and she talks a lot about how, you know, we have all this talk about how care is theoretically delivered and how it's really delivered at state hospitals, et cetera. Quite a good book. It's a little bit technical, but there's a wonderful book by researchers, see if I can pull it, it's called Drug-Induced Dysfunction in Psychiatry. It's technical. It's by Keshavan and Kennedy, and it just gives you the evidence. What does the evidence about these drugs show about different side effects, efficacy, etc.? Doesn't take a stand on whether the drug should be used or not. It just lays out the facts. Here's what the drugs do. here's the problems we're seeing with these drugs, and at least you can have that information. And again,
any new books you're working on?
Yeah, well, I have another book that's coming out in February. It's not on this topic, and now I want to come back to this topic for my next book, because frankly, I think the story of mental disorders that we're telling ourselves is profoundly changing our society, profoundly changing our sense of what it means to be human, and not in good ways. And I want to see if I can come back to that and look at what's happening to children in this country and how this medical model is doing harm to our country, because I think it's harming us in profound ways.
The name of your next new book, not on the topic of...
No, it's not. It's called The Mapmaker's Wife, A True Tale of Love, Murder, and Survival in the Amazon.
Hey, sounds like a good break.
I needed a break.
Hey, Robert Whitaker, thank you very much for being with us. I'm going to try to buttonhole you again soon, because there's a lot of follow-up I'd like to do. And I appreciate your being available. If we have some questions that are emailed in to rnorths2@hotmail.com, I'll pass them on to you.
Terrific.
And well, do you want me to give out your email address on the air?
Yeah, sure.
I'll do that too, so you can actually receive some information direct or some queries directly from folks.
Yeah, direct. That's great. They can just write. The way to do it is just go. I have a website called madinamerica.com.
It for Mad in America, the interview. Now we get Mad in Free Radio Santa Cruz. The time pressure. You have 3 minutes to call in your questions before the next. Yeah, we were going to have half an hour of questions and discussion here on the phone. The problem we have is that at noon we have a special guest calling in, a second special guest. It's actually Arianna Huffington's man in the area. He's actually a man who fights police abuse in San Francisco. Van Johnson, his name is. Actually, no, it's not his name. Van, what the heck is his name? Jones, that's it. Van Jones is going to be calling in. We're going to be talking to Arianna's rep. She's running for governor about homeless civil rights, and let's get that issue back on the agenda. Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, that I'm working with, has been trying to get the gubernatorial candidates to take stands on such things as, is it psychiatrically healthy to make it so that people can't sleep at night as Santa Cruz does under the sleeping ban? Actually, we weren't quite putting it that way, but you catch the gist. So that's coming up shortly. We haven't had a lot of questions emailed in, only two, in fact, so I don't feel too bad about doing this. I'm going to invite my co-hosts here to stay in the studio if they like, while we talked about homeless civil rights and the gubernatorial race coming up. That's again at noon. We're also going to be covering the subjects I often cover, which is we're going to be probably doing a few street interviews. We're going to be looking at court cases where people have been fighting back against the infamous downtown ordinances, the laws in Santa Cruz that criminalize such aberrant behavior as sitting down on the sidewalk within 14 feet of a building, asking for a dime after dark in a peaceful and respectful fashion, jaywalking across Pacific Avenue, things of this sort, which are, and in fact, the subject of court cases. If you wonder why they're throwing away money that should be spent to help save De Anza seniors, it's being spent by the city attorney, John Barisoni, and police chief Steve Belcher, retiring police chief Steve Belcher. Watch out for who comes next on that kind of nonsense, which essentially, I mean, it's social control of another sort. We've talked a lot about social control in the last 2 hours. This is a social control of another sort. We have an incoming call. Let's see what we got here. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Robert, is there any word when you guys are going to change your frequency?
You know, I don't have the word yet, but I think it should be pretty soon. And it's not going to be abruptly changed. It's going to be gradual. We'll be going out on two frequencies for a while, and then this frequency will be phased out because, as most of you know, we're getting blasted with fundamentalist Christian rock music, I think, and other problems from via Salinas.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it'll be happening relatively soon, huh?
That's what I understand. I'm not too clear. If you leave a message on the voicemail, you might get a more specific answer. For those of you who do have PSAs or want to donate things to Free Radio, that's another place to do it, 427-4523.
Okay, thanks, Robert.
Sure. So, yeah, I'm going to cut off callers quickly in about 2 minutes because I do want to get this call from San Francisco or Oakland. Van is in the Bay Area, I believe. We have some questions we're going to be asking him, and the questions are going to be, I'll kind of give you a preview. What are Arianna Huffington's plans for coping with homelessness in California since California was declared the meanest state to homeless people by the National Coalition? Does she support an effort to decriminalize homelessness? Does she support abolition of the statewide no-lodging law? Does she support a statewide resting exception that allows drivers to pull over and sleep in their vehicles rather than continue to drive and possibly be a road hazard? What sort of state support would she authorize for counties to provide shelter and services to homeless people? Would she support a study of the cost-effectiveness of a decriminalization effort so that fewer resources are used by the police, courts, and jails? And what would she do to provide alcohol and drug addiction rehab service for the indigent homeless? I'm, of course, going to ask her whether she favors the Pottinger guidelines. There's folks who are gearing up in Santa Cruz to fight the sleeping ban. There was a meeting yesterday afternoon of activists concerned with fighting the sleeping ban. You can leave a message on the Huff line, which I'll pass on to those folks. I don't really have a phone number for them yet, but they are working on a campaign to, I guess, fight the sleeping ban on the downtown ordinances. Jennifer, you were at that meeting. Do you have any report from that meeting?
I have Mike.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was there about as long as you were, Robert, and there's definitely a unified aspect of some people getting together to say it's ripe for change again in Santa Cruz and to look at what we're up against and to move in a direction to make it legal to sleep at night in Santa Cruz. I mean, just to correlate back to what Whitaker was saying about, you know, try a little bit of sleep deprivation for a week. A lot of these issues should be brought up, and the sleeping ban needs to go away.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, how a little firebugging of the asylum seemed to produce some salutary effects. We've seen, you know, people burning City Hall down or burning parts of City Hall, you know, burning other buildings, things of that sort. And we've had callers who suggested that this is homeless advocates or homeless people misled by militant homeless activists. My response to that is I've got no evidence of that, but I certainly would understand it. And if it has a salutary effect, good. I hope it does. Not that I advocate it as a process for proceeding. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello. This is Steve Argue.
Hey, Steve.
Hey.
Aren't you the man who's going to be going to court October 2nd on a move-along case because you didn't move your table along?
Yeah, actually, October 2nd and October 3rd for having a political table up for with literature for more than an hour, two different times. I wanted to call in about this human rights coalition that met yesterday. A group was formed, and it's formed on getting rid of the sleeping ban and the downtown ordinances, including the law that I was arrested under for having a political table. And the next meeting is going to be this coming Saturday at 3 o'clock in the park behind the Loudon Nelson Center there. So it's an ongoing group. We're going to be doing campaigns. It's looking like we're talking about doing, you know, some boycotts of some of the businesses that are behind the sleeping ban and the downtown ordinances, and or whose owners are, and you know, really putting some pressure on the local government.
Got to get you off the line, Steve. But
okay.
Is there a phone number you want people to call?
No.
Okay.
You should also have C.T. Weber, the Peace and Freedom Party gubernatorial candidate, on your show.
Why don't you talk about that after 12:30?
Right.
All right.
So I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye, babies.
Bye.
And so it's about noon here at Free Radio and all across the Pacific Daylight Savings time zone, although probably in some places the sun is at a different spot. We should be having shortly a caller from Van Jones who's not simply pushing Arianna Huffington, who's the left alternative or one of the many left alternatives. He got 135 candidates in this gubernatorial election if the recall succeeds. I guess he got the candidates running even if it doesn't succeed. Many of whom never get mentioned in the paper except as some sort of circus. You know, a lot of people criticize the recall as being some kind of Republican plot, which no doubt that's how the Republicans view it, and, you know, money is playing a part here. As far as I'm concerned, though, you're getting a lot of people actually get people able to speak out on issues, and the media paying minuscule attention, but more attention than usual, to people like Cameo and Huffington. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, it's Van Jones from the Arianna for Governor campaign.
Hey there, Van Jones. Aren't you one of those notorious police baiters and beaters and bad boys?
Well, no beating of anyone, but definitely opposed to police brutality.
And indeed, I commend you for your work in that way. I'd like to get an update on that first, as a matter of fact. I'll kind of short-circuit you. Is it possible you can tell us what's happening around the fight against police brutality in the Bay Area?
Well, the ongoing Ryder's case in Oakland is something that obviously is of real concern and interest. I think people know about the case of those four officers who were turned in by a rookie cop who observed them beating people, planting drugs on people, and otherwise violating the law. It's turned out to be the longest running criminal trial in the history of the state. It took, I think, 9 months or so to get the trial completed, and then since then the jury has been sequestered for months now, deadlocked and unable to come to any decision, apparently because there's some very hardcore pro-police sympathizers who somehow got onto the jury and who were not allowing the obvious guilty verdicts to come out. So even when police are charged, even when other officers turn them in, and even when there are trials, we still live in a country where the hype and the brainwashing around the infallibility and the heroism of all police officers prevents justice from being done.
I know, I read that there was, I guess, a few of the verdicts are resolved, but I guess it's a very complicated multi-charge trial. Were there dozens of charges?
Yeah, multiple defendants, multiple charges, and and so, but obviously if we were talking about just four city employees who were turned in by another employee for putting drugs on people and beating people up, there would be a very quick trial, and it would be over within an instant.
And one of the police has fled to Mexico or something?
It's true. Yeah, it's true. So there's a lot of, it's pretty obvious this is an organized little gang operating inside the police department. But
is there still such a gang, do you believe, operating in the Oakland and San Francisco police departments? Is that still going on a regular basis?
Yes.
Both departments?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You're Oakland-based mainly, or San Francisco?
We deal with the entire Bay Area, all nine counties. That we've been licensed by the State Bar Association to run the Bay Area Police Watch Project, and Bay Area Police Watch is the organization that monitors police brutality and unlawful police violence throughout the Bay Area. And it's fairly obvious that there are organized criminal elements operating within law enforcement in the major departments, but also it's also clear that even where there's not that level of organization, there is still a huge failure of any accountability mechanisms to be working. For instance, any human system that does not have adequate checks and balances on it will tend toward corruption and abuse.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you have, you know, building inspectors. That's why you have meat inspectors. That's why you have the IRS. It's not because you hate butchers or hate construction workers or hate taxpayers. It's just because you know that if there's no checks and balances, then you're going to have corruption and abuse.
Well, I know that a lot of us were encouraged when we saw that the runaway grand jury indictments of the heads of the San Francisco police force. What was your feeling when you read that newspaper headline that day?
Jubilation.
But then we all learned that they all got tossed out, and the jury proceeding was sealed. What was your analysis of that?
Well, there was clearly an awful lot of wrongdoing on the part of the officers who were who beat up the guy and took his fajita. But there's also wrongdoing and very, very weird behavior subsequent to that on the part of his superiors, partly because one of the officers, Alex Fagan Jr., was the son of the second-in-command, Alex Fagan Sr., at that time, second-in-command of the police department.
What about the chief, who is retiring and got some declaration of factual innocence? You think, what was your impression of him? Some regarded him as a very liberal fellow early on. He formed, what, Officers for Justice back in the 70s?
Mm-hmm. Now retired Chief Sanders is definitely a controversial figure within San Francisco politics and law enforcement. On the one hand, he was one of the first black officers to rise within the ranks. He certainly battled against the racism that was directed against his fellow officers. However, the racism that was directed by the department against ordinary people was not something that he was as strong speaking out against. And in fact, shortly after he retired a couple months ago, it was revealed that he took part in one of the most shocking and appalling frame-ups and cover-ups in the history of the city, which resulted in an African-American man serving 13 years unjustly for a crime he didn't commit. That man has since been freed only because of the San Francisco Bay Guardian's consistent reporting of this particular cover-up and frame-up.
His name?
The name escapes me right now, but
I think I remember the case, though. Yeah.
Yeah. But the chief of police, Earl Sanders, was involved from beginning to end, and that's one of the things that should give some pause to your listeners, even when you have an African American.
So, what significant reforms is Arianna Huffington going to do to reform the Oakland and San Francisco police departments? Should she, in the most highly unlikely event, be elected governor on October 7th if the recall succeeds?
Well, obviously, the governor has only indirect influence over local law enforcement agencies. However, there are a number of things that are now in state law that allow for so-called peace officers, police officers, to get away with murder, literally. There's something called the California Peace Officers Bill of Rights, and it's codified into state law a set of rights far above and beyond the rights of any other public employees, and far above and beyond the rights of any ordinary citizens, that basically ensure that police officers have several layers of insulation from normal criminal inquiry and normal disciplinary processes that, say bus drivers or firefighters or school teachers or nurses or other people who work for the government don't have. And so one of the key things would be to reform, if not to abolish, the California Peace Officers Bill of Rights so that their rights are not protected and exalted above the right of ordinary people to be free from unlawful police violence.
But don't police officers have obligations to answer questions suspending their Fifth Amendment rights in terms of departmental inquiries that most of us don't have?
No, that's not true. Police officers, in fact, it's the reverse. If a police officer is involved in an officer-involved shooting, before the officer even fills out the police report in the normal course of his or her duties, she is allowed to consult with attorneys, police officers, union attorneys, to help to craft literally the police report in a way that protects the officer from future litigation or disciplinary action.
But don't police officers, for example, in the cases of a police review commission in, not police review commission, I guess it is a police review commission in Berkeley, aren't they required, can't a superior direct a police officer to answer questions that they then have to answer?
Well, there is no employment rule or regulation that trumps the Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. So the person could conceivably lose their employment for failing to comply, but that would be true of any other employee. But the officer can't be forced to testify to anything that would result in his or her own incrimination in a criminal court.
Well, retiring Chief Steve Belcher here in Santa Cruz gives us a different story. We may have to get you down here head-to-head to do a little debating with him.
Happy to do it.
Huffington is running in a race that also involves Peter Camejo.
Yes.
Huffington's better funded than Camejo, but the two of them were pictured shaking hands together and even talking about a coalition effort where one would bow out if the other was ahead. Is that still agreement in force, or was there such an agreement?
There was such an agreement, but it was a little bit more complicated than that. The idea was that they would both run as hard as they could to build up their own support bases, et cetera, speak well of each other, support each other wherever it were possible. And then if we got within striking range of the election and one or the other were in a position to win, but for the other's vote total, for instance, suppose Peter was at 15% and Arnold was at 18% and Ariana was at 5%, then, you know, if the combined total between Peter and Ariana would give a victory to progressives, then whoever was behind would then bow out in favor of the one who was ahead. So it's not just like if one's ahead of the other one backs out, but if it would make a difference, if it would actually result in a progressive independent victory.
What statements has Huffington made regarding civil rights of homeless people at the state level, or even in her own local, I guess she's from Santa Barbara?
She was originally, her husband was representing Santa Barbara. She now lives in Brentwood in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh. Or even regarding the Los Angeles area, what has she done locally to support the civil rights of homeless people, and what does she propose at a statewide level?
Ariana Huffington has been one of the people who has consistently spoken out against the widening gap between rich and poor. You may remember in 2000, she convened or helped to convene the shadow conventions. And there were three themes of the shadow conventions, trying to expose the bankruptcy of the conventions of the Democratic and Republican parties. One was the failed drug war. The other was the need for campaign finance reform, and the third was the widening gap between rich and poor. So Ariana Huffington is somebody who's very clear in her anti-poverty stances. Her main concern at the state level, because obviously, you know, a lot of these are local issues, at the state level, her main concern is the overfunding of incarceration and the underfunding of healthcare, education, and other positive things in the community. As you know, we now spend in California more money on incarcerating people that we do on education at the higher education level. In other words, we spend more money on
right,
prisons.
I understand all that.
Let me just finish my point. We spend more money on prisons than we do on colleges in California.
Yeah, see, this is the same rhetoric, however, and it's not just rhetoric in her case, I agree, but the same position that the same Democratic Party politicians take locally who are oppressing homeless people. They would love to see less incarceration, and they favor, you know, ending discrimination against poor people in terms of, you know, equalizing income. But I'm talking about the H word, the homeless word.
Mm-hmm.
When has she specifically come out for restoring civil rights to homeless people?
Well,
I
don't know that she has taken a specific stand on the question of homelessness per se. I know that she has taken a stand on behalf of poor people and the need for affordable housing, the need for the tuition hikes and other things to be rolled back, and even to have free educational opportunities for people who are trying to better themselves, with regard to having an explicit, well worked out or elaborate policy on homeless issues. Obviously, this race is only 60 days, and
I'm not asking you to apologize for it. And I'm just trying to find to clear the information. But I want to tell you that we hear the same kind of, frankly, to me, it's obnoxious kind of rhetoric. And you're not obnoxious, and I'm not questioning your sincerity. And frankly, I think she's much more sincere than any of the local politicians are on this issue. But the same babble about affordable housing and, you know, general concerns about poor people without addressing very specific things that were, for example, brought up in the national report recently by the National Coalition for the Homeless on the criminalization of homeless people in city after city in California. I'm talking about criminalization. Yes, the drug war impacts them. Yeah, you bet. Let's get rid of the drug war, no question. But the actual criminalization of the right to sleep at night, the criminalization of the right to perform life-sustaining functions. These are things that are illegal, for example, in Santa Cruz. I don't know if they're illegal in Brentwood. I know there have been efforts to pass laws that eliminate the so-called, I don't know what they are.
Certainly, what you're describing is a widespread phenomenon here in San Francisco.
Right.
As I'm sure you're quite aware, the front runner in our mayoral race is one of the most poverty, anti-homeless bigots to ever, you know, surface in San Francisco politics.
Gruesome
in a
Gavin.
City, that would be Gavin Newsom, in a city where many demagogues have been able to make a lot of hay attacking our most vulnerable community member. So, you know, you're, it's certainly not limited to Santa Cruz. Unfortunately, picking on people who are in a vulnerable situation is a very common problem. Ariana Huffington, again, is somebody who has had no problem at all taking on the, you know, the big bullies in California. And I know from knowing her personally and knowing where her sympathies lie that any concrete proposals to get the state government more firmly on the side of decriminalizing homelessness and creating affordable housing, those are the types of things that she would immediately gravitate to and would want to push and to promote.
Well, hopefully we can send to her the latest report of the National Coalition for the Homeless on, well, there's national legislation that makes it illegal and essentially cuts off federal funding from cities that have anti-homeless laws. Something like that could be done at a state level. There was a march by homeless people last year called the Right to Sleep March, which went to Sacramento asking Governor Davis to make an executive order essentially declaring the right to sleep for poor and homeless people in situations where there is life-sustaining needs and where there's a necessity. I would like to see Huffington and frankly every other candidate very shortly come out with a specific endorsement of restoring civil rights specifically for homeless people.
Yes.
And perhaps we can get this to you and we can get a more concrete statement from her when she's read the documents.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, one of the things I think that we have to keep in mind is that California, you know, state 35 you know, million people, fifth largest economy in the world, you know, the most populous state in the United States, economy is bigger than the economy of France. One of the problems I think that we've had has been the divisions within our movement for progressive social change, and you know it should not be the case that a constituency group you know like people who are homeless and people who care about people who are homeless and people who understand how frankly we're all fairly marginally housed in this economy it should not be the case that we aren't all better informed about what the answers are. This is one thing that I do know is that the fact of the problem is something that weighs on the minds of a lot of people, including Ariana Huffington. And I think there's been a concerted effort on the part of the media to make the solution seem non-existent. And so one of the things I know we would like to be able to do in this campaign is we continue to try to burst certain bubbles of public misperception is to include that within her overall approach.
Well, good, because next Thursday is when my show comes on again. I'll be happy to report, if I get such a response from you and Ariana Huffington HQ, that you are, in fact, endorsing the end to things like sleeping bans,
yeah,
laws that criminalize homeless people in public spaces downtown, like sitting bans, panhandling, where we're talking about peaceful panhandling bans.
Yeah.
I want to see a specific statement from her, and frankly, from every other candidate, before I would recommend anybody even bother to walk out of their house to do anything for these candidates, because it's all very well to talk about these generic statements about the poor. I want to see, I'm concerned about the poorest of the poor here, and I'd like to see the other candidates do the same.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's fair, and I'd love to see that. And I can, knowing Ariana Huffington, if there's a concrete, specific proposal that would make a difference, I'm quite sure that not only would she approve of it, she would probably improve upon it by adding more than you would necessarily ask of her, because that's how she's been with the clean energy proposal that she's making a big speech about tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the clean energy environmental people came to her, and she mm-hmm. actually was able to, once she understood the range of the issues, she you know, came up with ideas that they hadn't even come up with. So
perhaps my producer can talk to you. She or you or another spokesperson is welcome to call in between Thursday from 6 to 8 and, you know, endorse, you know, it's relatively simple. We're looking for a strong statement against laws that criminalize poor people. You can even weaken it by saying there should not be, if there is no affordable housing or shelter bed available for a homeless person, that person should not be approached. This was the tack taken in Florida under the Pottinger guidelines in Miami, actually ruled by a federal judge in the early 90s and confirmed in the late 90s. Police officers don't approach homeless people on so-called life-sustaining misdemeanors like building a fire, camping outside, having a tent, sleeping, even public nudity, where that's a necessary part of a life-sustaining function. If I'd like to hear from you or from her or from someone in your campaign that in fact, statement is either endorsed or
sure.
not endorsed.
Well, great. Let's do that. I bet your viewers would like to hear more about some of the other things she actually is championing. And I wonder
sure.
if we could maybe move the interview to some of those points.
Right. Okay.
So,
well, in terms of stuff that's going to immediately impact homeless people, and I do appreciate, by the way, you're giving us the update on the police situation and clarifying what Ariana's position is on the, or may well be, who knows, on homeless issues in that respect. If you got any other stuff to tell us, please do.
Okay. Well, I mean, one of the things I do want people to know about is that tomorrow Ariana will be speaking in the Bayview Hunters Point area on the question of the clean energy initiative that is gathering some steam here in California. As you undoubtedly know, California has, you know, huge pollution-based energy concerns, from, you know, PG&E to the Chevron refinery at Richmond, that, you know, have caused incredible health damage, especially to people of color and low-income people in general. And so often when we talk about clean energy, renewable energy, those kinds of things, the conversations very quickly become, you know, about sort of like the concerns of upper-middle-class white environmentalists who like, you know, windmills or solar panels on their houses. And there's very little discussion about the need to have clean energy, so that the source of energy is not polluting and toxifying the environments of the poor people who live close to those refineries and those institutions. So Ariana's speech on tomorrow will be directly addressing the question of a need for clean energy in California, not only to reduce dependence on Middle Eastern oil, and not only to help to further along the solar and wind and other renewable industries as job creators, but also just to spare the health and the lives of so many low-income people and people of color who are suffering because of asthma,
gotcha,
cancer rates that are off the charts, et cetera.
Do you have a website people can go to for more specifics on
the
position?
Yes. You know, voteariana.com is the website name, voteariana.com. Ariana's name has one R and two N's in it. And it's a spectacular website. One of the things that people like about the website, especially those people who have, you know, DSL and high-speed access, is that we do have a number of videos, including two flash movies. One of those flash movies is called The Hybrid versus the Hummer, and it has Ariana Huffington racing Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
She's driving a hybrid, which is a more fuel-efficient, clean energy vehicle. He's driving a Hummer, and his Hummer keeps running out of gas.
But nobody's carrying a backpack or hitchhiking along the road like most of the audience that I'm concerned with. That's the problem I have here.
Yeah, I can see that you have only one issue you want me to talk about.
You were giving a fair warning. You saw the seven questions we sent you, you know, about the different homeless laws. So you I'm not sandbagging you, right?
No, it's fine. I think that probably in a governor's race, people are interested in hearing a number of the issues, and I appreciate your concern. And
the mainstream media has covered your stuff in terms of to some extent about what's going on with renewable energy and, you know, and lack of pollution. I mean, I go for that, and you've mentioned it already. But I do want to focus on these civil rights issues. That is my particular interest, and I'm not trying to be discourteous to you. I'm being a little hard on you because I'm hard on every political candidate. I don't think much of politicians, even politicians of the left, unless I see them out there doing stuff the rest of the time. And Ariana has been writing. I like her writing. I'm glad that she's been raising issues. And I'm glad, and your work, of course, I'm most impressed with in terms of your fighting, you know, police misconduct. Unfortunately, I'm running out of time. Give you a couple minutes to sum up why you think a homeless person should pay some attention to Ariana Huffington.
Well, I think that part of the problem with California is that, you know, California's economy has been, you know, decimated not only by the things that constantly are referred to in the newspaper, but also because of simply, you know, the Bush tax cuts. I mean, what happens when George Bush and whichever one of the George Bushes you're talking about, they come into the office, they wreck the economy, and they start a war. And it makes it a lot harder to fix some of the problems and help the people who maybe are chronically jobless when the job market is shrinking instead of expanding. And so I think that the only candidate who's consistently stood up to George Bush throughout this entire process and pointed out that a lot of these problems are California's problems, but they're not of California's making, and that a lot of the source of some of the problems that we have is in Washington, D.C. Ariana has been that candidate. She's been that voice. I think that people who are marginally housed or who are in fact homeless should recognize when you have someone who's brave enough to take on George Bush in this you know, wartime climate, she's certainly going to be brave enough to take on the developers, the people who try to block affordable housing at any turn, and those people who want to misuse the criminal justice system and law enforcement to punish people for being poor, as opposed to spending those monies more wisely to make sure that people are housed and have the services that they need. And so I think that if people who are marginally housed, people who are in fact homeless, are looking for a champion who's willing to stand up on tough issues and stand up for causes that need a champion, Arianna Huffington is that champion, and I hope that people will consider casting their vote for her.
And what about local concerns, advocates of stopping police violence in Los Angeles? Do they favor any particular candidates down there? Have they got anything to say about her? Has she done any specific assistance in trying to stop violence in the LAPD? Do you have any details on her? Did she comment much on the Ramparts scandal? Do you know much about that?
Well, yeah, she was. She mentioned in a number of her speeches here and down there about her concerns about the abuses of the law enforcement system, the racism within the criminal justice system. Obviously, is one of her main themes in her column, which she returns to again and again. She was one of the people who helped to break the Tulia scandal, where that almost an entire African American town was arrested on drug charges based on one white racist snitch's testimony, and eventually those convictions were overturned and those people were released. Arianna was one of the first reporters columnists to write about that, to consistently write about it, keep the spotlight on it. She's very concerned about
local Los Angeles stuff in her home community.
Well, obviously she writes a national column, so she's not going to be writing about, you know, her a national column requires, you know, those stories that have a national reach. No, she's spoken out against unlawful police violence in a number of speeches. Obviously people who are more interested in her position should go to voteariana.com.
Hey, appreciate your taking the heat. Appreciate your spending the time to call. Van, thanks. I hope we can catch you another time. We can get some more details on. And what I really want to talk to you about is how can people in any particular small city in California deal with police misconduct? What's the best way to start to organize? That's something you've been doing for years, right?
Yes.
Hey. We can talk about that another time, maybe?
Maybe.
Anything you want to say about that now?
Nope.
Okay. Thanks for calling in. I don't think he liked that. Okay. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And this is Free Radio. You can get in touch with us here at 427-3772 if you have any thoughts, anything you want to say. We've been talking with Van Jones of the Arianna Huffington campaign, and we have about a half an hour left in the show, so you have an opportunity to talk about subjects really of your own choosing. Again, we focus here on low income, homeless topics, civil rights topics, and of course, for the first 2 hours, we were interviewing Bob Whitaker, who's the author of Mad in America. Still in the studio with me is Coral Brun, who can provide a response and some thoughts if you get tired of listening to me. I'm right now going to give you a little comic break from one of my favorite old-time ditties from the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe. Actually, I've got a lot of them. I don't know if this is my favorite, but it's certainly an example of the kind of satire I'd like to see us doing here in Santa Cruz.
The City of Berkeley invites you and your tax dollars to advertise your products on Berkeley's own Channel 25, BTV. If your condominiums aren't selling, why not take prospective buyers on a video tour demonstrating the selling points to your customers in the comfort and privacy of their very own homes at the public's expense? Our team of BTV videographers has nothing else to do since public access questions won't be settled for quite some time. In the meantime, the City of Berkeley invites you and your colleagues in real estate to come on down and put this vital public resource to some good old-fashioned commercial use.
Wow, Martha, look at the view they're getting from that high-rise condominium. That's the same view we used to have before they built the damn thing.
Well, we can't afford the $200,000 this month to get our view back, Harvey, but we sure can make a down payment on those community policing steak knives.
You're right. Let's call them up right now, Martha.
The new Berkley Shopping Channel may be just the boost your business needs. Call today for our one-stop streamlined commercial access arrangement. And tell your friends. Channel 25, BTV. We're putting the private in public access.
Looks like we lost our machine there. What's happening? Let's see what we got going on here.
The nation was shocked recently at the revelation that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has kept tabs on the nonviolent AIDS advocacy group known as ACT UP, while simultaneously claiming that it was unable to keep a close watch on militias and violent right-wing groups. Here to explain the FBI's actions is James K. Kahlstrom, FBI Assistant Director in charge of the New York office. Tell us, Mr. Kahlstrom, why ACT UP instead of, say, the Michigan militia?
Well, it's simple, really. These militia guys have lots of guns. They train all the time. You gotta run up and down hills, all the survival gear on. You know, it just gets kind of old.
But still, ACT UP, this group has a completely peaceful history.
Hey, that's nothing. We kept files on the American Jewish Committee, the American Jewish Congress, Gay Men's Health Crisis, the Center for Immigrants' Rights. None of those groups were violent either, but we got tons of stuff on them.
But why?
Why not? That's what we do, lady. Just keep it in shape in case we get lucky.
Then why is the FBI refusing to release 177 pages of the file on ACT UP?
Well, we got some infiltrators spread around the country, you know. We wouldn't really want there to be any hard feelings if word got around they were really the FBI. Plus, some of them are really having fun. The ACT UP people are a lot more fun than the militia people, let me tell you.
Well, constitutional considerations aside, Mr. Kahlstrom, do you experience any concern that your focus on nonviolent groups might leave the country somewhat at risk?
Hey, lady. If you want to run up and down hills with survival gear wearing camouflage, be my guest.
And that's the word on the ACT UP surveillance from James K. Kahlstrom, FBI Assistant Director in charge of the New York offices. I'm Ruby Ring, signing off for National Pirate Radio.
And on the, we have a squeal on the air, but we also have some interesting information coming over on the air. Hi. Hello? Hello? I thought we had some interesting information coming over. It looks like we haven't. Okay. I just got word from Becky Johnson, my producer, that there's a meeting at 5:30 at De Anza Mobile Home Park today. That's at the end of Delaware on Schaefer, around the city council sellout of the De Anza seniors and what to do about that issue. And she may have some more information. We got cut off there. Let's see if we can find her on the phone. Hi there. Hello.
Yeah, I had to turn my radio down.
Yeah, we had the same problem here. Sorry.
Okay, so am I on the air?
You are on the air. Go ahead.
Ah, okay. I did talk to some of the people from the De Anza Senior Mobile Home Park, and of course, tragically, one of their members has been hospitalized in Stanford with an aneurysm. She came to the city council meeting on the 23rd and was feeling poorly, went home, and the next day she had a massive stroke. Which many people believe was stress-related to the fact that the seniors are, you know, the rent control has been voted out by the council on a second reading.
Surely you're not blaming our city council, which is only trying to help the majority of the 55,000 hardworking citizens of Santa Cruz.
Right, and Scott Kennedy had that email at the very end. Oh, I got an email from some guy that said, you know, why should we spend that much money on a couple old people? So I guess, you know, he got the other side to weigh in there. Of course, it was unanimous in the chambers at both meetings, unless you count the representative from Manufactured Homes Communities of Chicago, who did speak at the first meeting in favor of the resolution. But I had some questions about that. If you look at City Manager Dick Wilson's statements about where he claimed it would cost the city $100,000 a month in legal costs to pursue this, that it, the math doesn't seem to add up. He says that they've already spent $750,000 over the course of 4 years, but now it's suddenly going to jump to $100,000 a month. There was really no explanation why that cost would be so great, unless maybe they were going to be going to trial all at once on a lot of different cases. Then they might have $100,000 that month, but I can't see why it would be $100,000 a month in perpetuity. And when you're talking about the amount of equity that the seniors are going to lose at De Anza, you have 198. I'm getting a lot of background noise here. I hope. Robert?
Yes.
I'm hearing a lot of background noise, and it's difficult to maintain my concentration here.
Oh, okay. Well, I think you made some good points. I'm looking. A number of things have kind of showed up on the rent control scandal radar here for me in the last few days. If you look at Heather Berner has written a brief article in today's real estate section of today's Sentinel, where she finally allows the residents to do some speaking. Heather, who did a really horrible job of covering homeless civil rights issues at City Hall, has done a much better job of approaching the De Anza stuff. That's been my impression. The trouble is that, like people as late as, Christopher Crone had a column in yesterday's Sentinel, which he asks questions similar to what the kind of questions you've been asking about. Where are the specifics behind the city manager's claim it's going to cost $100,000 a month in legal fees to continue, and that somehow it's not legal for the De Anza people to contribute money to a legal fund to help fight the,
they were recommending MHC. A special assessment district, which where all the people in that special district would get a charge, and it would go into a very specific earmark fund that could be used for litigation. And apparently the De Anza residents have already collected enough signatures saying they were in favor of this, that they could be assured that it would achieve the two-thirds majority needed to pass. All indications are that...
two-thirds majority of what?
Of the people who reside in that special assessment district.
Oh, I see.
Because, the way the law is written, you can't pass a new tax unless two-thirds of the voters agree.
No, you're talking about in the De Anza Mobile Home area.
Well, those would be only people who would vote, would be the people who are... Mm-hmm.
That it's environment that's so strong. So we talk about, oh, we're going to find it's genetic, et cetera, et cetera. And yet all the research we've done now up to this point tells us that the genetic part of this, there might be some genetic vulnerability, but genes don't, there's no schizophrenia gene. It isn't there. So we're just spending money going down this path because, we can do genetic research, and there's money for it, and it makes us feel all talented and skilled and advanced. But I'm very cynical that it's going to really help those so diagnosed. And one last little quick thing. We recently read that, they might have found a gene for depression. And what they found was it seemed like